cliffcentral.com. For the morning, Andrew Brown. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Gareth. How are you?
I'm very, very well, thank you. An interesting book. I didn't make it the whole way through because I've just been swamped with work in the last couple of weeks. But what I did read was fascinating. It's a first-hand account of some of the stuff that goes on in Cape Town that many of us don't really fully understand or comprehend. You know, we seem to think, and I remember I spoke to a guy a while ago who had written a book about Cape Town and the gangsterism, particularly in the flats, and how it's a totally different Cape Town to the one that tourists see, the one that you see if you're living in the city or even better on the Atlantic seaboard. Even in a place like Hout Bay, the dichotomy is so incredibly varied that you go from Masiphumelele right into, you know, this tourist trap of fancy restaurants and botanical gardens and people's magnificent houses and views that go on forever and ever. It's a different experience when you're a police reservist, right?
Absolutely. I mean, Cape Town's got such a long way to go. It's my city, it's my hometown, and I love it. But it's, in terms of transformation, in terms of socioeconomic change that needs to happen, I think it's probably the worst city in South Africa.
Really? That's quite something to say. And I wonder if Patricia DeLille would be thrilled to hear you say it.
I know. I wonder if any of the DA members
would just be like,
damn it. Oh, they just revealed the truth.
Look, you are talking to an old ANC hack, so let's just put that out there.
So first things first, when I played that Those Were the Days song...
That hurt, right? Yeah, that
you
hurt,
shed
Gareth.
A tear.
Yeah, that's
I
really
see
hurt.
You squirming a little in your seat. All right, so Andrew, first of all, you're not a cop full-time, but being a reservist means you get called on to help out, basically, and you are trained, and you have to go, and sometimes reservists deal with some of the tougher situations. Because that's when they need extra people and they need people who have got experience.
It's a great system. It's very flexible. You have to do a certain number of hours every month. Mm-hmm. So you come on and you do ordinary duty as a police officer. When you put your uniform on, you're as same rank as your permanent officers. There's no difference.
Mm-hmm. Why would you ever sign up for something like this? You're an advocate, right?
I'm an advocate, yeah.
All right. So you've got plenty of stuff on your plate already. You deal with just enough crime and violence being an advocate in terms of people suing each
other. And just being
a
citizen. Yeah.
Sure. And being a citizen in South Africa is hard enough. We just heard about Dumi Shomasha being hijacked. But you want more danger in your life? What kind of... do you not like your family? Do they not like you?
My poor family.
Your poor family.
It came out of the 80s. So I was an activist. I was in the UDF. I was in the ANC underground. I was very involved in activism in the 80s. And then 1990 came and we got what we wanted. And 94 came and we got a constitutional democracy. And we weren't politicians, we were activists. We were fighting for something. And a lot of people, myself included, it was a bit of a shock. Mm. What do you do now? How do you make your contribution now that we now are a democracy? And
so
people struggled with it.
You felt a sense of civic duty there.
Absolutely. And I looked around for a few years to see what it might be.
Couldn't you have just done free legal aid or done some pro bono cases?
We do that as well.
So in other words, I mean, you're just a do-goodnik, which
just
is
one of one of those irritating do-goodniks, yeah.
No, I mean, I thank God for people like you. But really, police reservist, every time you go out, you're at as much risk as a full-time police officer.
Yeah, you are.
I can't imagine that your family are thrilled about this.
You know, it's been incredibly beneficial for my family in a strange way, and let me explain why. When I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, if I saw a policeman or a police van coming, I would run the other way. They were the enemy. Those were the people to be feared. If I had my bicycle stolen or I was mugged in the subway or something, I'm not going to go to the police and tell them about it. I'll just get on with it. Mm-hmm. Now, my children know the names, the first names of all the policemen in the police station that services our area, which is Mowbray. Mm. They are friendly with them. They will go and chat to them in the police station. The van will stop and talk to them. They've got no fear. They understand we're a police service. We're there to serve them. So it's changed my children's perception of the police force forever. And that's not a luxury that you or I had, I think, growing up under apartheid, or even in the early 90s. And I think that's a gift that I've been able to give them that I'm delighted with.
Yeah, look, that is quite a thing to be able to say to your children. But you're in an interesting place if you're at Mowbray Police Station, because you're right in the you're in a nexus of different worlds,
yeah,
effectively. You do have the flats right next door. Just a little further than that, you've got Nyanga, Khayelitsha, those areas. Mm. You've got the very wealthy southern suburbs where you've got places like Bishop's Court and Constantia where only rich people live.
Mm.
When you go out on patrol or you do your particular tasks associated with your job as a reservist, which change from time to time. Sometimes it's fairly innocuous stuff. Sometimes it's extremely dangerous stuff. When are you most aware of the sense of personal danger? Because I don't think it ever goes away, right? You can't ever drop your guard.
That's probably the hardest thing, is that the real danger doesn't lurk when you're in Nyanga and you're aware that you're at risk. Mm. Or in Hanover Park when you know the gangsters are about. The real danger lurks, and most policemen are injured or killed in situations where they didn't see it coming. Mm. You pull a car off on the N2 because it's driving badly and you think it's a drunk driver, and the next minute, actually, they are housebreakers, they're armed, and you're in a whole lot of trouble. So a lot of people will complain about the police being over-aggressive, and we are sometimes, but the reason for that is that we don't know what we're about to face. So I've pulled people over and being quite aggressive initially because their windows are tinted. I can't see who's in the car. And so I'm trying to dominate them physically. Once I realize it's Mr. and Mrs. Smith coming back from the spur, then that's fine, and yeah, we can all relax.
Mr. Smith really shouldn't tint his windows that dark.
Well, he shouldn't. He really shouldn't, and he shouldn't also be drinking and then coming back on the end too. So it's difficult to know how to react in terms of personal safety. What does amaze me, you talk about working at Mowbray, it's the interconnection of all the different communities that meet in Mowbray. It's the working class, it's the prostitutes, it's the middle class, it's the wealthy classes of Rondebosch. My constables who I work with, who are permanent force, generally live in Blue Downs, Khayelitsha, Athlone. They come on duty and they risk their lives to protect other people's possessions.
Yeah.
And they do a 12-hour shift of putting their lives at risk, and then they go home. And in the case of Rondebosch or Mowbray, they're there to protect your flat-screen TV. They don't have one. When they go home, they don't have a flat-screen TV, but they'll put their life on the line to protect yours. And I think that's quite astonishing.
It is astonishing. But we live in such an interesting country because there really is, you know, Thabo Mbeki said it's the two different South Africas. The author of this book, Gang Town, which is Cape Town, he told me the same thing. Mm. They're two very different Cape Towns. But it must be interesting to live on that intersection of these two worlds, because you get to have colleagues who you have to rely on for your own personal safety and security. You know, you probably wear a bulletproof vest, but that you need your partners. You need the other guys who are on the force to help you navigate some very dangerous situations. So the trust has to be entire and total.
100%. You need to trust your partner, whoever it is. And it may be, you can't always know who it's going to be. It may be a young constable who's just joined the force, or it may be the partner that you work with often. You've got to have complete faith that they're going to back you up. And I had one case, it's a chapter in the book called Schizophrenia, where I'm trying to explain what it's like to be white and middle class and living in where I live. And then going off into, in that case, Bokmakiri and Athlone, which is a working class area, a lot of gangs, and trying to reconcile those two parts of my life. And working with a young student constable who came from Bokmakiri. So he knows gangs. He knows what it's like to live in a gang area. And we got called into Langa where there was a shooting at the taxi rank. And he leopard crawled away. He couldn't deal with it. We were being shot at by Tsotsis. And the next minute I see my partner leopard crawling across the tarmac trying to get away. And I said to him afterwards, what happened? Why did you panic? And he said, this is so out of my comfort zone. I know I come from a gangland, but I understand gangs. I understand what they're doing. This is completely out of it. And he then said, what do you call it when you have two parts of your life and you can't put them together? And so the chapter is called Schizophrenia.
What are the gangnans like for a start? Let's go to places like Hanover Park, where really, I mean, for some people, this is the scariest place in South Africa, because you've got these gangs, extremely powerful, entrenched. Their tentacles reach down to children. There's this powerlessness in the community to resist them. It's as a result of all kinds of socioeconomic evils. But what is it like to be in there at night?
You know what has changed everything, I think, on the Cape Flats, and that's Tuk. So I think you can divide those communities and policing in those communities into a pre-Tuk era where I think we stood a chance and a post-Tuk era where I think we don't.
Why is Tuk so dangerous?
Because it's so cheap. So we have caught gangsters handing strawberry Tuk out for free to primary school students because they want to hook them. They want their market. And it's so cheap that they can do that. Anybody can make it in their kitchen if you know what you're doing. So there's this flood of cheap available drugs that are highly addictive, incredibly dangerous. And it's changed the face of gangsterism. It's changed the face of the Cape Flats. And it's turned some of those places into hellholes. Somebody asked me recently, if you live in, let's say, the worst part of Lavender Hill, can you have an ordinary life? My answer to that is, I don't think so. If you have children, I don't think that you can live without fear if you're living in the bad areas. Sure, you can. There are lots of good areas where you can live. But those bad gang areas, I think those tentacles go right through every part of the community.
Is it hopeless then? I mean, as a policeman, if you say it is, then I'm very concerned because I don't know that anyone can fix that.
I don't know that we're ever going to get on top of the gang problem. And has anyone in the world got on top of their gang problem? No. So I don't think we must expect too much of our police force to get on top of it. We can try and control it. We can try and reduce the number of deaths. I suggested to one of my colonels that what we should do is actually take all the gangsters and teach them how to shoot straight because they keep hitting innocent children when they're shooting at each other. Now, if I can take them to the shooting, hold them on the side.
I've seen too many Hollywood movies.
Exactly. If we could just get them to shoot straight, they'd take each other out, and then our problem might be solved. But it does feel hopeless at times.
I mean, what do we do? Let's imagine that you had 23 officers for every gangster. Let's have a complete fantasy scenario. You can't rehabilitate that guy. Even if you apprehend him, you send him to prison. In prison, they're sometimes more powerful than out. Because the prison system is corrupt and rotten at the very core. In fact, prison, you would say, almost calcifies these people.
It's an extension. Right? It's an extension of the gangs. My view, crime is not a policing issue in this country. That's my view. My view is that crime in this country is a political, socioeconomic, state, government issue.
How so? What do you mean by that?
You're never going to turn Lavender Hill around by putting cops into it. We might reduce a few deaths, we might arrest a few more people, but it's not about the number of cops you've got on the ground. While those people live in those conditions, with these kind of inequalities, there are always going to be that issue. If you look at Masipumalele, it's not going to come right while people are living without drinking water, without waterborne sewerage, with a communal tap that has to serve 500 people, with sewerage in open trenches everywhere. You're not going to get them right.
So what would fix it? I mean, if you were a politician, what would you be able to do?
Let me tell you one.
A cop couldn't.
Let me tell you one very short story about Bushbuck Ridge. So I was coming out of Kruger, and we hit Bushbuck Ridge, and there was a huge EFF protest in the road.
Just to give everybody the context, Bushbuck Ridge is a huge, sprawling township with very little money, huge socioeconomic deprivation. People don't have jobs. People are furious.
Yeah.
It's right on the exit to the Kruger Park, where you've got all these fancy tourists with their pearls.
Rushing through.
Rushing. They drive through Bushbuck Ridge as fast as they can. Yeah. It's unsightly. It's unpleasant. And then they're in the Kruger Park where animals are treated in five-star fashion. And the people just outside the gates are pretty much treated like animals.
Yeah, pretty much. So we get stopped at this protest at Bushbuck Ridge. And there are pipes across the road and there are barricades burning. And I get out and I go and talk to them and say, look, we need to get to Nelspruit Airport. What's the problem? And the one comrade there says to me, no, you're not coming through here, I'm afraid. We're blocking this for as long as it takes. We have no drinking water. We've had no drinking water for years. These are the pipes that have been bought for the drinking water, but there's no money to put them in the ground. So I said, okay, that's fine. That makes complete sense to me. You understand? So I walk back up the hill, and there's the police from Bushbuck Ridge. There's a captain standing with his shotgun. I went to talk to the captain and said, well, what now? And his answer was, I have a shotgun, I don't have a spade. Oof. And that's the point. You don't send in the cops, you send in the engineers. When Masipumalele starts rioting because they have no drinking water, they sent in 200 policemen.
But the people of Mpumalanga have just returned the ANC to power in even greater numbers.
Yeah, they have.
Mpumalanga is the province that most backs the ANC in terms of percentages. And the people of Bushbuck Ridge must have been able to go to the polls. You have to ask yourself, is there an understanding of what possibilities exist in terms of change for a community like that? Or are they captive to their own history?
I think that in more rural areas, we remain captive to our history. We've seen the metros change. We haven't seen the more rural areas change at all.
Is that an effect also of education as a sort of primary byproduct of the socioeconomic stasis?
Gareth, it would be very easy for me to say yes, but I have to make a confession. I am educated. I have voted for the ANC every single time until the last election.
This one you changed your mind.
Yeah, I voted for the EFF this election.
Well, put it there. I'm in the same boat you are.
So, you know, I'd like to think I'm educated, but I have that loyalty is very strong.
You don't want to be patronizing by saying, oh, well, you know, it's only because they don't know enough.
Yeah. Absolutely.
People vote a certain way. But you have to ask yourself, where is the solution? Because if there isn't a desire for a change at the level of the community, then when the community doesn't have change, who's to blame but the community?
Yeah.
You know, regardless of their level of education or otherwise. This is a very sad situation. What you said is so powerful. Send in the engineers, not the cops.
Yeah. What the theme of the book is really is my concern that the police, which was a police force and is now supposed to be a police service, is being used increasingly to deal with community protests. In a country with poor service delivery, you don't want the cops to be keeping communities quiet. You want the cops to be looking at crime.
And then we do see things like Andres Tatane, and we see things like Marikana, and the cops become public enemy number one.
Yeah, we get demonized.
Now, we don't need that.
No.
I mean, I've always been on the side of the cops in that these are guys who are meant to be on your side.
Yep.
They're meant to be the people you can rely on in a tough situation. What you're trying to teach your kids about the police station.
Yeah, we're there to serve you. That's supposed to be the lesson.
But how did it unravel? How did we get to this point? How would the police better be run so that we don't end up in a situation where the police become the bad guys?
Masipumelele is a good example. So Masipumelele is a township outside Komaki in the Western Cape. Komaki is a very white, very liberal, very wealthy suburb. And next to it is this little wart, this high-density township called Masi. Terrible conditions. And they started protesting, and it turned into a full-scale riot. And police went in with shotguns and tear gas for weeks. When I walked in Masi, the children had put all the shotgun cartridges on the wall in patterns. There were so many shotgun cartridges, if you could make patterns with them. That's what the kids were doing.
Like their action figures.
Yeah. And to cut a long story short, finally the politicians put a small police station in Masi, and I was the first officer to run it. So the very first shift of the Masi police station, I was the officer in charge. And there were only three of us, two constables and me, to look after Masi. And
how many people did you say?
There are thousands of people. I think I think there's 40,000 or 50,000 people in that township.
So this will be easy.
Yeah, this will be easy. There's three of us, and there's and there's 50,000 very, very angry people out there who haven't had good policing for years. Right. And the question is, the three of us got together, and our question was, okay, how do we do this?
You've got a chance here at a blank slate because there's never been a police station.
There's never been that.
All right.
And our answer was, we locked our guns in the safe. Contrary to standing orders, we could probably all be suspended for doing it, but it's what we did. Wow. We put our guns away, kept our uniforms on, and we did foot patrol, unarmed, in Masi. And we had not a moment's problem. We were hugged, we were kissed, we were offered tea, we were walked with, we had trails of kids walking behind us, all saying, oh, Mzungu, Mzungu, and I'm a police, because they hadn't had foot patrols in Masi. They didn't know that this is what policing could be. And we did it day after day after day until, I'd like to think, that community started to understand this police station is our police station. We can actually go there and get service from this police station. That's how I think you turn policing around. Not trying to keep a community quiet. Not trying to stop them from protesting about their conditions. That's a service delivery issue. That's not a policing issue. We need to get out there and walk.
So what... What exactly is it, or why is it that the politicians are failing then, in your opinion? Because, you know,
They clearly are, and this in the Western Cape.
And this where, in the Western Cape,
where everybody says this is a paragon
we're
in government.
We're
going to
throw the DA right in there because clearly they're failing. Why is it that they're failing? Is it because they don't care? Is it because their hands are tied? Is it because it's just a very difficult job to try and get done right?
It is a difficult job, and I think obviously we understand that it isn't easy, but I think it's a lack of political will. I think that unless you're making enough noise, unless you're burning enough tires, you're not going to be seen as somebody in need and you're going to be ignored. And there are all these communities that are falling behind, are being ignored, are being left out in the cold. And if you look at our wonderful constitution, all those rights that are entrenched in the constitution, the state has an obligation to ensure that people have those rights. And you can't just walk away from communities like Masipumalele and so many others because you're having a political fight about where you're going to get your votes from and jockeying with the ANC or jockeying with the EFF. It's just not good enough.
Here are a couple of comments, and I want to hear what you think of these. The book is called Good Cop, Bad Cop, by the way, and it is by Andrew Brown, our guest this morning. It's a fascinating story of really a bird's eye view from the primary, the principal in the story, as you made your way through some very, very dangerous and supposedly safe neighborhoods in Cape Town, and the kinds of people you encounter there. We'll get into why the suburbs aren't necessarily safer in a moment. But Roman says here, gangs are created through the trade in illegal substances, drugs, prostitution, etc. If you legalize vices and you treat people as patients and victims, you take away financial power from gangs and assist victims as victims. Do you believe that's accurate?
I think there is a lot in it. I think you don't legalize all substances. There's no doubt that dacha must be legalized in this country. It should have been legalized.
It should be.
Yeah, absolutely. It should have been legalized in 94.
prostitution. As a policeman, though, you're not empowered to exercise your own discretion in terms of a guy who's carrying around some weed in his car.
All right, should we get into true confessions here?
Yeah.
Okay. My police station. I have not seen anybody arrested for possession of dacha in years. I've seen people arrested for possession of huge quantities. They're clearly dealing in it.
Okay.
I've never arrested anybody for any amount of dacha in my life as a cop, and I've been a cop for nearly 20 years.
Could you be in trouble for that?
No. I think everybody would understand that I have that discretion. Strictly speaking, yes, I should be. You know, the broken windows New York policy of policing, I should be arresting every lighty walking around with a spliff in his mouth.
But I mean, in Cape Town, that would keep you busy for the rest of your life.
Put the whole community away. Yeah, we don't have jails big enough for that. Yeah.
So which drugs don't you think should be legalized?
We have to get a handle on TIC. You know, if you legalized heroin, for example, or cocaine, you need a lot of money to be addicted to those drugs. Those people do become victims. I don't have necessarily a problem if you go and legalize those kind of drugs. But Mandrax took the scourge of the flatlands. That we have to get a handle on. And that can never be legalized.
And how do you even stop it when people, as you said, can make it in their kitchens?
Yeah. It feels unstoppable at times. We need better policing around it. And then sex workers, of course it's got to be legalized. I mean, what is this nonsense?
Well, it's just making them, you're making them second-class citizens.
Absolutely.
By punishing them a second time for what they've already decided is the only course of life for them in order to make a living.
I can't tell you how many times I've been on duty and I've been called to a disturbance of the peace.
Yeah.
And you get to the disturbance of the peace and it's a prostitute and her customer having a fight about price. As a policeman, you're supposed to arrest both of them.
Yeah.
In fact, what we do is we say, right, what's the problem? She says, I gave him a blowjob, it's $50. You say to him, do you get your blowjob? Where's your $50? Pay the lady. He pays. He goes home shamefaced. She gets her $50. Everybody's happy. I mean, is that a problem?
What a fantastic use of state resources to ensure the contractual obligations of a hooker and her clients
just
to
pay
each other.
Her.
It just keeps the peace. I mean, ultimately, all we want is to keep the peace. Yeah. Otherwise, you can have people hitting each other in the street. Yeah.
Smita Hira says that she's loving this discussion. And King K says, you don't want to keep people quiet by sending in the police. Economic transformation in our lifetime. He obviously feels that that's a powerful statement. Clint from the Val says, that sentence of yours, the line, I have a shotgun, not a spade, will stick with me. Very powerful stuff. So obviously, what you're saying here is the stuff that I don't think ordinary South Africans get to hear enough, which is why your book is so important. Have you had to check any of this with your bosses at the police before you publish it? Because obviously there are implications politically, there are implications for the leadership within the police. Who are you responsible to before you can print stuff like this?
It is a sensitive issue. The Police Act says that you're not supposed to disclose any details about the police force, whether you're inside or outside the police force. It's all supposed to go through the spokesperson. You can imagine how little information you're going to get from the official police spokesperson on any of this. So no, it is sensitive. I may get into trouble.
You haven't yet?
I haven't yet. I released a book a few years ago called Street Blues that was quite similar, and I was told that there were going to be disciplinary steps taken against me.
Nothing happened.
And nothing happened. My defense to them is this is a very personal account. I'm not trying to look at it from anybody else's perspective. I'm not trying to look at it from the police force's perspective. This is about how I see it as a citizen of South Africa, a human being. So it's quite confessional. It's quite personal. I'm hoping that I'm not going to get into trouble.
What about these high-walled suburbs where rich people, it's not just white people anymore, because there are a lot of rich people in this country who are not even South African. They're from Germany, or they're from Nigeria, or they're from wherever else in the world they come from. But in the suburbs, you would assume there's this tranquil, leafy, restful, happy existence for the people who've worked themselves up to that level of livelihood.
You would be shocked what goes on behind the leafy walls.
Right, so tell me about some of the things. Obviously, you can't mention specific cases and names and times and all the rest, but what kinds of things have you seen there?
Domestic violence is the biggest one. Sexual abuse of children, of women, violent abuse of women. There's a lot of it. South African men are
assholes.
Yeah, they're not great.
It's the stain of our nation, isn't it?
Yeah,
the way that
it is. The way we treat women. Yeah. 100%. It is. The Domestic Violence Act is a good act, and the police are generally good at enforcing it. The problem is it happens behind high walls, and unless you pick up the phone and phone me, I don't know it's happening. And I never know.
You can't just bust in and say, I heard there was something going on here.
Yeah.
So what about spoilt rich kids also? I mean, there's a lot of that in Cape Town.
There's
trust fund children running around shooting things and driving cars into trees. And
There's a chapter in the book called Crystal Meth or Just Crystals, and it's a story about pulling over an Uber full of rich kids. And we search them because we think they've got drugs, and the one kid opens his knapsack and all these powders fall out onto the bonnet.
It wasn't sherbet, was it?
Well, you see, so my constable sees this and he's saying, cocaine bust. And I'm looking at these powders and they're kind of folded up in a piece of wax paper. It looks familiar, but I can't quite work out why it's familiar. And look, in my youth, I did a bit of drugs, so I know what...
So you know what this is.
So I don't know if this is ringing a bell, because this is now something that I remember from my past, but it's a strong bell and it's getting stronger and stronger, and we're about to lock them up. And I look down at them and I realize, of course, they're homeopathic powders.
Oh, you're joking.
Yeah. And then you got to explain to my constable from Blue Downs, who wouldn't know homeopathy if it bit him on the bum.
I mean, what a ridiculous thing to carry around.
Absolutely. You know, what are these powders? And I'm saying, no, they're crystals, but not those kinds of crystals.
Right.
They're different kinds of crystals.
So what
and he's
these,
not getting it. He's
so there's
just
a car full of hippies.
It's a car full of hippies,
oh, how pathetic. Pathetic. Homeopathy will kill you. Tell you what. Have you ever had a situation where you almost made a very, very bad decision? I mean, you must have many of these, but one that sticks out for you, where you could have pulled the trigger and caused irreparable harm, or you could have been in a situation where you made a terrible error of judgment and ruined someone's life as a policeman, because you hold such power.
That's really the problem, is making that decision and getting it right, and it's so easy to get it wrong. And the one example is we were given a story about a hijacking that had happened, and we followed up the lead and we found the guys, and we obviously went in, we were told they were armed, so we went in very heavy, very aggressive, guns drawn, guns pointed. Turned out to be a hoax, complete hoax. Now, if one of those guys had, let's say, gone for his cell phone,
you would have shot him
because out of fear, because you believed the story.
You know,
so it's so difficult to get that right.
Andrew, how do you keep the adrenaline under control? Because when you are in fight or flight mode, and as a policeman, you must be in that situation a lot. You know, dark nights, rain, lights in your eyes, weapons going off, drugs, gangsters, murder scenes, ugliness all around you. Your heart must be 18 years older than the rest of your body. How do you manage to keep that under control? And how do you go home? And you're a reservist. This isn't your full-time thing, but it's just as trying and traumatic. How do you go home and relax after a night out on the job?
You take a lot home with you. What's interesting is writing this book, my family have said to me, we didn't know all of those things about you. We knew those incidents happened, but you didn't share the emotional trauma with us. And they're right, I didn't. It's in the book, but I don't go home and share it. More to protect them, maybe to protect myself as well. Mm. What's interesting for me is that it's not the big traumas that hurt policemen. The big traumas, you're aware, this is a trauma, I need to deal with it. You get counseling. You look after yourself. You maybe take some time off if you've had a really bad scene, something shocking has happened. So it's not the big stuff that gets to you. Mm. It's the small stuff. It's the small stuff that as a tough policeman or a tough policewoman, you're not supposed to feel.
So children.
Children, domestic violence, the death in the motor car accident, you know, the everyday policing that you deal with. It slowly accumulates and you see it in the police officers.
And there isn't really enough of a counseling therapeutic socialization that happens with cops after that. Yeah. No one sits them down and says to them, hey, how you feel about this? What's going on in your
life?
Not
for the small stuff. You know, I had a young woman stabbed and die in my arms. And that was seen as a big thing, which it most certainly was for me. And I was told, you don't come back on duty until you've had counseling. And that was the right thing to do. But within a month after that, I had a death in a motor vehicle accident. And that was just seen as, oh, how was the motor car? And on.
Have you filed your report?
Have you filed your report? Let's get on with it. And it's as distressing. There's a dead human being, you know, that you've got to deal with. So cops are carrying a lot. How do you deal with the adrenaline and those situations? Training. You've got to, you do an annual shoot, you do an annual SWAT course. You've got to keep your training up to keep your control in those situations. I just saw some stats come out of America that were quite interesting. Mm. The first 5 months of 2016, 520 people killed by the police, which I don't know if that's a big figure or not. It's a huge country. It sounds like quite a lot, 520 people killed by the police. Of those, 200 were black and unarmed. Now, that's a huge figure. And if you switch that around, because obviously our police force is largely black, if our stats were 200 white unarmed people, so they've been racially profiled and they're unarmed.
Oh, people would be up in arms. It would be
the biggest thing ever.
Chaos.
Yeah, it would be chaos. So,
but in America, obviously, it is chaos in America around this. If you're a black person in America, you don't enjoy being out in the streets and knowing that the cops might be nearby.
Yeah.
It's a terrifying situation.
So they seem to have lost control of their police force in that way.
Well, listen, it's a pleasure to meet you and great to hear some of your stories. There's a lot more where that came from. King K says, where can I get your book? Where is it available?
All exclusive books, all the private bookshops, they've all
there
got
we
it.
Go. So head on down to exclusive and take a look at Andrew Brown's book, Good Cop, Bad Cop. Thank you so much for joining us this
Thank
morning.
You, Gareth. Absolute pleasure.
A fascinating story and something I think probably a lot of people would like to hear more about, and you can go and read the very personal account by Andrew of his life and the stories that I think will get you really, really, it's just harrowing. It's harrowing stuff, but it's also quite inspirational to know that there are cops out there who are not the bad guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gareth. Nice to meet you. Thanks. CliffCentral.com.